Who was responsible for the anthrax letters sent to legislators and media in the fall of 2001? What was the motive of the perpetrators, and how are they connected with the crime of 9/11? What is behind efforts by Senator Bob Graham, among others, to link the 9/11 hijackers with the Saudis? Are there specific examples of 9/11 coverage over the last 15 years that teach us about the power of media control? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we continue our special look at the 15th anniversary of 9/11 by speaking to Professor Graham McQueen of McMaster University and the co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies about the anthrax letters sent out to key individuals weeks after the 9/11 attacks. Then we speak to Professor Michel Chosudovsky about present-day efforts to link Saudi Arabia with the 9/11 hijackers. Finally, media critic Barry Zwicker returns to talk about his experiences with media suppression of 9/11 truth over the last 15 years. On this week's program, 9/11 Truth 15 Years Later, Part 2, The Anthrax Letters Blaming the Saudis and the Media Campaign. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of September 16th, 2016. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. For all the rhetoric that we often hear about the market and large corporations offering choice to farmers and consumers, the evidence is restriction of choice and the squeezing out of competitors. Over the years, for instance, Monsanto has bought up dozens of competitors to become the largest supplier of genetically engineered seeds, with seed prices having risen dramatically. Consolidation and monopoly in any sector should be of concern to everyone, but the fact that the large agribusiness conglomerates specialize in a globalized, industrial-scale, chemical-intensive model of farming that is adversely affecting what we eat should have us very concerned. Do we want this system to be intensified even further just because their business models depend on it? That comes from the article, Monsanto and Bayer, Why Food and Agriculture Just Took a Turn for the Worse, by Colin Todd Hunter, posted September 15th. Hansen and Roberts hail from a long line of populists suspicious of the quote-unquote international institution, which they regard as something of a meddling, threatening Frankenstein. But it is Roberts who couches matters with greater meaning, adding zest to armchair paranoia. It is doubtful, for instance, whether Hansen has any serious understanding about what global institutions actually do. In truth, there is very little to be suspicious about such institutions as the UN, so bogged down in its own self-serving wishes, a bureaucratic clot incapable of actually pursuing the aspirations it has set. Changing the world as an aim through non-binding commitments is far from actually doing so. That comes from the article, Australia's Global Exit, Tribalism and International Institutions, by Dr. Binoy Campmark, posted September 15th. Dr. Omalu became famous, at least in the U.S., when Hollywood produced a film called Concussion. Actor Will Smith plays Omalu in the film, based on his discovery and how the NFL tried to silence him. Dr. Omalu is now suggesting that Hillary Clinton was possibly poisoned by either Putin or Trump. Fame can be addictive to some people. Maybe Dr. Omalu likes the spotlight, so he decided to join the mainstream media, MSM, conspiracy theory bandwagon. One of the reasons Dr. Omalu gives us is that he does not trust Putin or the Republican frontrunner Donald Trump. Here's a quote. He wasn't giving up on Twitter, adding that his reasoning is that he does not trust Russian President Vladimir Putin or Donald Trump, the Republican presidential nominee who has expressed admiration for Putin. That comes from the article, Strange Washington Post Conspiracy Theory. Renowned medical doctor claims that Putin or Trump could have poisoned Hillary Clinton, by Timothy Alexander Guzman, posted September 15th, originally appearing at Silent Crow News. The new ceasefire agreement between Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, which went into effect at noon Monday, has a new central compromise absent from the earlier ceasefire agreement that the same two men negotiated last February. The new agreement incorporates a U.S.-Russian bargain. The Syrian Air Force is prohibited from operating except under very specific circumstances, in return for U.S.-Russian military cooperation against Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, also known as Daesh, ISIS, or ISIL. That compromise could be a much stronger basis for an effective ceasefire, provided there is sufficient motivation to carry it out fully. The question, however, is whether the Obama administration is willing to do what would certainly be necessary for the agreement to establish a longer-term ceasefire at the expense of Daesh and Al-Qaeda. In return for ending the Syrian Air Force's operations, generally regarded as indiscriminate, and lifting the siege on the rebel-controlled sectors of Aleppo, the United States is supposed to ensure the end of the close military collaboration between the armed groups it supports and Al-Qaeda, and join with Russian forces in weakening Al-Qaeda. That comes from the article, Al-Qaeda's Ties to U.S.-Backed Syrian Rebels, by Gareth Porter, posted September 15th, originally appearing at Consortium News. A recent report showed that the carbon pledges made by 178 countries in Paris last December won't be nearly enough to save most tropical coral reefs and cloud forests, let alone preventing mass global extinctions. Another recent report showed that ocean slime, composed of toxic algae blooms, is rapidly spreading across Earth as a result of warming ocean waters. The toxic algae is worsening dead zones and wiping out parts of the food chain for marine life, causing collapsing populations of sea lions, seals, various bird species, and fish around the planet. Lastly, a recent report warned that we are already locked into far more planetary warming than most folks realize. Given that humans continue to inject over 30 billion tons of CO2 into the atmosphere annually, and the fact that what is already there has us locked into, conservatively, another 1.5 to 3 Celsius of warming in the coming decades, the new climate reality is upon us. That comes from the article, Record High Temperatures, Toxic Slime Spreads Across Oceans as Climate Disruption Continues, by Dar Jamail, posted September 14th, originally appearing at Truth Out. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. One of the aspects of the 9/11 anniversary, seldom mentioned anymore, is the follow-up episode of letters containing a weaponized form of anthrax to various media outlets and legislators. Five people died as a result, and the scare had been used at least temporarily to ramp up support both for the USA Patriot Act as well as the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. One person who has returned our focus to the anthrax attacks is Graham McQueen. Professor Graham McQueen received his PhD in Buddhist studies from Harvard University and taught in the Religious Studies Department of McMaster University for 30 years. While at McMaster, he became founding director of the Center for Peace Studies at McMaster University, after which he helped develop the BA program in peace studies and oversaw the development of peace-building projects in Sri Lanka, Gaza, Croatia, and Afghanistan. Gray McQueen was a member of the organizing committee of the Toronto hearings held on the 10th anniversary of 9/11 and is co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies. He is the author of the 2014 book, The 2001 Anthrax Deception, The Case for a Domestic Conspiracy, published by Clarity Press, and this book will be the focus of our interview. The author joins us by Skype from Hamilton. Good afternoon, Professor McQueen.
Hello. It's good to be here. Thank you.
It's great to have you. Could you maybe inform our listeners, what is it that caught your eye about the anthrax attacks that you sought to make it the focus of your book?
Well, first of all, I had been studying the so-called 9/11 attacks for some years, and I knew they were a fraud, and I thought, oh my God, this is really important, but now I'm hearing stuff about the anthrax attacks. I'm hearing that that the anthrax in those letters came from inside the U.S. military-industrial complex, and I had read this in other people's, you know, articles and so on, and I thought, wait a minute, if that's true, that's really important. So I thought, you know, I'm retired and I have the good fortune to be able to take time off when I want to. So I just cleared the desk and said, I'm going to look into the anthrax attacks and find out at least what the basic facts are about them. And I quickly confirmed that, yes, it's true. They were a fraud. They were blamed on Al-Qaeda and Iraq. And in fact, the spores were traced to U.S. military lab, that is to say, a lab serving the U.S. military and intelligence communities. So I thought, as I looked further, I found something else that I hadn't known before, and that is that there was overlapping personnel in the two attacks, in the 9/11 attacks and in the anthrax attacks. Some of the same guys, namely the so-called hijackers, showed up in both. And somehow that had escaped my attention before. So then I thought, well, wait a minute, this is extremely important, because if the anthrax attacks are provably a fraud, right, if they provably came from within the U.S. military-industrial complex, and if they have the same personnel, the same guys involved in them as in 9/11, then this is another way of showing that the 9/11 attacks were a fraud. We've already got all kinds of ways of showing that they were a fraud, but this is an interesting angle. And it also suggests that this was one operation, not two. It was one operation with two parts. So that's when I decided to really get into it. I wrote an article, and then somebody said to me, you know, that could actually be a small book. And so one thing led to another, and it became a book.
Now, I wonder if you could just recall, both from your own research and your own recollections of 15 years ago, what were the impacts of those anthrax letters at that time, coming right on top of the 9/11 terror attacks?
Well, the truth is that if I try to put myself back to that time, I could barely remember them. You know, I mean, the anthrax attacks were pretty big news in the U.S., a little bit less in Canada. And the scare was big for a while and then quickly went away. And you see, this is part of the story. Part of the story is that once it was found out that they didn't come from Islamic extremists and all the rest of that cooked up story, there was a tendency to, well, not just a tendency, I think it was a deliberate effort on the part of the FBI and other agencies to sweep the whole thing down the memory hole. And so there are many people today, including many Americans who were adults at the time, who barely remember them. Oh, yeah, something about anthrax in the mail. You know, because it didn't turn out right, did it? I mean, you know, the story fell apart. It fell apart very rapidly. By the end of 2001, it was gone. It was in tatters. And so that really is, that turned out to be part of my mission and part of the point of the book, to remind people that, wait a minute, you know, you can't forget about these, because they could be one of the major keys to unlock the door to the global war on terror.
Yes. Now, as you pointing out in the your opening remarks, the attacks seemed aimed at people in this instance, they seem to be aimed at people who were in a position to expedite the passage of the Patriot Act, Tom Daschle and Leahy, through the Senate and the House of Representatives. They also served propaganda functions of linking 9/11 with Iraq. So do you have any insights into whether one or the other was the prime motive, or is it impossible to kind of separate the two as motives?
Yeah, it's very difficult. I'm always reluctant to pretend to know more than I can actually prove. What is clear is that anthrax letters were sent to two senators, as you pointed out, both Democratic senators, and both after they had slowed down the passage of the Patriot Act. And this is not rocket science. I mean, Cheney said he wanted the act passed by October 5th, but it wasn't passed on October 5th because of two senators who slowed it down. Then, somewhere between October 6th and 9th, letters were put in the mail containing deadly anthrax to precisely those two senators and only those two senators. Right? So it's pretty obvious that it was an attempt to intimidate them and indeed Congress more generally, which wasn't passing the Patriot Act as quick as the neoconservatives wanted them to. On the other hand, as you pointed out, there was far more going on than just intimidating Congress to pass the Patriot Act. One of the functions, I'm absolutely certain, of the anthrax attacks, just like 9/11, was to facilitate attacks on foreign nations. And by the middle of October, as you pointed out, the theory that was gaining momentum was what I call the double perpetrator hypothesis, which is that Al-Qaeda, you know, had prepared the actual letters with their misspellings and their clumsy printing and all the, you know, Allah is great, death to Israel, death to America, all that nonsense. And that, you know, Al-Qaeda wasn't sophisticated enough to make this stuff, this actual physical anthrax. And so that had come from Iraq. So they managed to try and frame, basically they managed to justify the invasion of both those countries, you know, and it would have worked, except they made some big mistakes and the story fell apart.
Could you zero in on those big mistakes? I mean, you mentioned that the tracing this particular strain of anthrax to Fort Detrick, there was clearly an intention, well, it seems like, I'm following what you put in the book, that they wanted a sophisticated state apparatus so that they could somehow pin the blame on Iraq and just thereby justify that invasion. But they used a strain that Iraq doesn't use and that's traceable to the United States. Why did they make that? I mean, is it really that difficult to see that this isn't going to fall apart? Was it just incompetence? What are your thoughts? Why?
Again, I would need to speculate, and there are different views on that in the small community of people who study the anthrax attacks. So, you know, my view isn't necessarily the same as everyone else's. One thing was noticeable, and that is that when it was discovered it was the Ames strain of anthrax, people did not immediately conclude that it came from the United States. In fact, there were articles in major U.S. newspapers saying that that information was not helpful in pinning it down because the Ames strain had become so common that it was all over the world and probably wouldn't help in narrowing it down. Now, that turned out not to be true, but it may be that the perpetrators were a bit sloppy there and thought they could pass it off. The other thing is, as you know, it wasn't just the strain of the anthrax that was used that turned out to be a fingerprint. It was also the weaponization process, microencapsulation, especially in the case of the anthrax that went to the two senators. And again, how could they have been so sloppy? Well, there was a major propaganda effort, we have to remember, in October and to some extent beyond that, to make it look like the weaponization process was Iraqi. ABC News was especially complicit in this, and they said they had four high-level, separate, you know, experts who said that there was bentonite on the anthrax spores, and that only Iraq used bentonite. to weaponize its anthrax. And they were really pushing that story hard. But unfortunately for them, they seem to have allowed, some scientists seem to have got into the game here who weren't supposed to be in it. In other words, some genuine scientists actually got a look at the anthrax spores, or in some cases, they got a look at studies of the spores, and they kind of scratched their heads and said, there's no bentonite here. This isn't Iraqi, and it certainly isn't Al-Qaeda. This looks like our stuff, And I mean, even the armed forces, like the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, studied the spores and put out a little report, which I have. It's quite brief, but it says, no, there's no bentonite here. So my guess is that the conspirators, and I don't mind using that term because that's what they were, who put this thing together, thought they could keep the circle fairly small and handle it. They had felt, well, we've got control of the media. We'll have ABC put out some baloney, you know, and we've got control of this and that. And so we don't need to read in all of these scientists and military people and so on who might, after all, not want to go along with this. And I think, you know, somewhere along the line, they made a huge mistake there because the whistle was blown on them to a large extent by people that you would think of as insiders.
Now, talk about they're moving on to the lone wolf perpetrator scenarios. The first, Stephen Hatfill and then Bruce Ivins, who apparently committed death by suicide by swallowing a lot of Tylenol. Now, why did the U.S. authorities move to that particular scenario? As their, what was it, damage control? What did it serve any other purposes other than to, as I say, you know, just trying to move away from the failed Iraq implication there?
No, I think you've got it right. It's damage control. It's option B. It's what's sometimes called a limited hangout, where you allow certain parts of the truth to come out, but you lie, you continue to lie about essential parts. So what are you letting out? You're saying, oh gosh, it does seem this anthrax is our own. Seems like it came from our own, you know, military industrial complex. In this case, they're saying it's from Fort Detrick. And Bruce Ivins was a scientist who worked there, you know, and he had to have certain clearance and so on. And they're saying, damn it, you know, it did come from in our inside. So they're admitting it's an inside job, though they don't use the term. They're admitting it's a false flag attack that was blamed on people who didn't do it, though they don't use that term either. But what are they hiding? Well, they're hiding what's rather obvious, and I argue for it in my book, and that is that it wasn't done by any individual, whether Bruce Ivins or anyone else. Everything about this says it was done by a sophisticated, widespread network of people, just like the 9/11 attacks. And that's what they're keen on hiding. And if you can make your lone wolf, which is the term they use, into a lone nut, so much the better, which is exactly what they tried to do with Ivan. So he was on medication, he was unstable, some of which is true, but it didn't mean he was the anthrax killer. I've seen never a smidgen of convincing evidence that Ivan's had anything to do with the attacks. But, you know, stress his instability and make him more unstable. Show up at work, harass his family, say you're going to seek the death penalty, and get the guy scared out of his mind, which is what they did. Whether he actually took his life because of all this stress or whether someone just killed him as part of the operation, I frankly don't know. But either way, whether directly or indirectly, the FBI is responsible for that man's death.
And dead men tell no tales.
Exactly. I mean, you know, they didn't have to have a trial. It's hard to imagine how they could have won if it went to court. I mean, they had nothing. So as in so many of these incidents within the war on terror, the alleged perpetrator somehow dies and the court case is avoided. If you look in Canada recently, 2013, 2014, right? You find in 2013, the guys they set up, you know, John Nuttall and Amanda Carotti, actually, you know, are allowed to live. So there's a trial and the RCMP is disgraced. They're disgraced. It all falls apart. In 2014, on the attack on Parliament, the so-called terrorist takes 31 bullets. So there will be no trial.
I'm wondering, in the bit of time we have left, the efforts to link the architects of the anthrax deception with the 9/11 hijackers, with the architects of the 9/11 attacks. Could you, concretize that bridge for us?
Yes. Well, it's difficult to do without PowerPoint slides, but I give in my book several examples of how particular people that we know that are called the 19 hijackers. Okay, let's forget about the question for the moment as to whether they actually hijacked anything on September 11th, but they're called the hijackers. So several of them show up in the preparations for the anthrax attacks. So, for example, a woman named Gloria Irish turns out to be the real estate agent of the first man to die of anthrax. And she turns out to be the real estate agent of several of the 19 hijackers as well. Well, that's kind of weird. What are the odds of that? And as we begin to look into this, we see, for example, that the so-called leader of the hijackers, Mohammed Atta, is running around the place, making himself very visible, and trying to do things like get the U.S. Department of Agriculture to give him a crop duster plane. So that, and he says, I'm an engineer. I'm going to modify this so I can dust all these crops without having to re-land and refill. And then he threatens to cut the throat of the U.S. Department of Agriculture person who's interviewing him. And he makes all kinds of comments about Osama bin Laden. And the whole scenario is so absurd, you just want to laugh. So this is obviously a guy who's, I don't know if he's really, his name is Mohammed Atta or what his name is, but he's running around acting a role, and he's laying down a trail of breadcrumbs that we're supposed to follow. And that trail is supposed to connect 9/11 and the anthrax attacks. That's its aim, because remember, Saddam Hussein was said to have to want to use crop duster planes, to spread his anthrax. So suddenly there's all this stuff about crop dusters, and these hijackers are running around trying to get crop duster planes. And you see, they were successful in laying down a trail of breadcrumbs, and the press and everybody was cheerfully following the trail until the whole story fell apart.
I just want to ask you one more question, if I may, Professor McQueen. It's been almost 2 years since your book came out. I was wondering if you've seen any new revelations on the subject of the anthrax that may figure into the overall scenario with regard to 9/11.
Well, certainly. Not long after the book was published, we had a major whistleblower, Richard Lambert, who was for a time the head of the FBI's anthrax investigation, got into a serious conflict with the FBI when he left the agency and tried to get a job elsewhere, and they blackballed him. And he took them to court. And one of the things that he says, if you read it all, his document, is that one of the reasons he's being harassed is because he blew the whistle on the anthrax attacks. He says that his office was, in effect, set up to fail. He said there is, I think the term he used was, a wealth of exculpatory evidence. In other words, a whole bunch of evidence showing that Bruce Ivins, the lone nut, which the FBI still officially calls the anthrax killer, shows that he was innocent. And there's evidence there, he said, that the public has never been shown, that the FBI is still sitting on. And really, when I read his thing, I thought, well, this just confirms everything I said in the book. And I suppose if I ever bring out another edition, I'd have to discuss that.
Professor McQueen, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, you're quite welcome. It's been enjoyable.
We've been speaking with Professor Graham McQueen. He teaches at McMaster University in Hamilton, and the title of his 2014 book, again, is The 2001 Anthrax Deception, The Case for a Domestic Conspiracy, and it's published by Clarity Press. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. A relatively new development in the 9/11 saga revolves around 28 pages that had been redacted from a 2002 congressional inquiry looking into the attacks. The 28 pages which had been classified are said to detail specific financial links between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the 9/11 hijackers. Coinciding with the 28 pages, we've noticed an effort in recent months to pass legislation allowing families of 9/11 victims to sue the Kingdom for damages relating to 9/11 and their supposed involvement in the attacks. A bill recently passed through the U.S. House of Representatives enabling such lawsuits to take place. Senator Bob Graham has been spearheading the effort to implicate the government of Saudi Arabia in the execution of the 9/11 attacks. What are we to make of these recent developments, and how does it alter the war on terrorism moving forward? Who benefits from the accusations against Saudi Arabia? Joining me to discuss this latest wrinkle in the 9/11 storyline is none other than Michel Chossadovsky. Professor Chossadovsky is an award-winning author, professor of economics emeritus at the University of Ottawa, founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, and editor of Global Research. He joins us now from Montreal. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor Chossadovsky.
Delighted to be on the program.
Now, I followed your research on 9/11, and that research seems to primarily focus on the links between Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, and the U.S. intelligence apparatus. Is it possible you could just very briefly outline some of those telltale links?
Well, I started investigating 9/11 right at the outset, and at the outset, that was the lead to look at Al-Qaeda and the links to the CIA. But if we look at more recent findings, particularly those of architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, what the conclusions are that Al-Qaeda under no circumstances could have brought down the buildings. And neither could Saudi Arabia supporting these hijackers, because that is what is contained in the 28 pages. There's a very close-knit relationship between Pakistani intelligence, Saudi intelligence, and U.S. intelligence. And we know today that Saudi Arabia is supporting ISIS. Okay, so but Saudi Arabia is doing it on behalf of the United States. So that, in effect, it inserts a red herring into the debate. But the irony is that Bob Graham, and I've been following Bob Graham right from the beginning, Bob Graham makes the following assessment, which in effect contradicts his whole argument. Well, this is a quote. He said, former Senator Bob Graham, who chaired the congressional inquiry into 9/11, stated, "None of the people leading this investigation think it is credible that 19 people, most who could not speak English and did not have previous experience in the United States, could carry out such a complicated task without external assistance." Now, again, it's very contradictory, because then he says, well, Saudi Arabia is behind them. But in effect, whether it's the CIA or whether it's Saudi Arabia was behind the terrorists, those terrorists were there to serve a propaganda purpose. Okay, because there was a whole narrative on the terrorists, on the hijackers, and so on. I don't want to get into that, but the evidence suggests that they could not have brought down the buildings, because that required a level of sophistication which they simply did not have from their flying schools in Florida and so on and so forth.
There is a term, I think Webster Tarpley uses the term patsy, and I guess that's what you're essentially saying, that these hijackers are patsies.
Well, we could call them what we want, but the thing is that right from the beginning, there was a propaganda campaign. And Bob Graham and Portagos were involved in that propaganda campaign. They were talking about state sponsors, and then they pointed to Pakistan's ISI, the money man, and so on. I don't want to get into that. But bear in mind, officially on the 12th of September, when the Atlantic Council, namely NATO's governing body, met in Brussels, they said that Afghanistan was the state sponsor of terrorism because allegedly Osama bin Laden was being harbored by Afghanistan. They didn't actually mention the word Afghanistan. They said a foreign power, and they didn't say what it was. But then some people actually said, how come we're invading Afghanistan? You got your countries mixed up. Most of the hijackers are Saudis. And Saudi, that from day one, that statement was made. Why on earth, what justifies an invasion of Afghanistan on the grounds that Afghanistan was protecting the terrorists? And there was no evidence to that effect. And in fact, the Afghan government at the time approached the U.S. State Department and said, if you have any indications that Osama bin Laden is behind these tragic events, we will deliver him to the U.S. justice system. And the response by the Bush administration, in fact, by George W. Bush, was, we do not negotiate with terrorists.
A circular argument.
In effect, Afghanistan wanted to avoid a U.S.-led invasion, which had been planned well in advance of 9/11. But then Afghanistan had been identified as a state sponsor of terrorism. So you see now, if we come back with the Saudi thing and say, oh, Saudi Arabia was behind the terrorists, this might create a little bit of political embarrassment, because then they might say, well, the Bush administration got their country screwed up. Okay. They invaded Afghanistan instead of invading Saudi Arabia. But in effect, what this whole 28 pages thing is really, what it really serves is to create confusion within the 9/11 truth movement. And we can see it as somehow the controlled demolition discourse is parallel with the 28 pages. And now those lawsuits, incidentally, against Saudi Arabia were right from the beginning. Okay? There was a lawsuit against alleged brother-in-law of Osama bin Laden, a multi-billion dollar lawsuit on behalf of the victims. But again, we're within the realm of propaganda, and they're using this to more or less diminish the credibility of the controlled demolition thesis, which is unequivocal, by introducing something new and then saying, oh, the Saudis are behind it, we must go after the Saudis, we have lawsuits, we must invade them, whatever. And this serves essentially to create utter confusion within the 9/11 truth movement.
I'd like to back up a little.
And my response is say, well, assuming that Saudi Arabia is responsible, they act on the orders of Washington. They always have acted on the orders of Washington.
I'd like to back up a little bit. You mentioned Senator Graham's involvement in the 9/11 saga precedes his attempts to implicate Saudi Arabia. He was very much involved in the days leading up to 9/11. Individuals, like the head of Pakistan's ISI, there was a meeting there. Maybe you should just outline some of the peculiar, Mr. Senator Graham's peculiar involvement with regard to that.
Well, my understanding is that Senator Bob Graham and Representative Porter Goss were involved in what I would call the propaganda preparation of 9/11. In other words, they went to Pakistan in late August. Okay, I think they returned to the United States something like, but on the 28th or 30th of August. And then the head of Pakistani intelligence, whom they had met there, he arrived in New York somewhere around the 4th or 5th of September. And then on the morning of September 11th, they were having breakfast together, et cetera, et cetera. And then there was a whole series of snippets in the news and reports to the fact that Pakistan's ISI were covertly supporting the hijackers. And then at the same time, the head of Pakistani intelligence met up with with the U.S. State Department, with Colin Powell, et cetera, et cetera, and made the firm commitment that Pakistan would wage the war on terrorism against Afghanistan. So this was all part of the propaganda preparation of 9/11 to pin it on the state sponsors. And at the time, the state sponsors, which were mentioned, was Pakistan or segments within the Pakistani intelligence community on the one hand, and two, the Taliban. Okay, now it just so happens that the so-called Taliban contacted the Washington and said, okay, if you want Osama bin Laden, we'll be happy to hand him over. And then, of course, there was another occurrence which was confirmed by the report of Dan Rather, and it's important, is that on the 10th of September, Osama bin Laden was hospitalized in Pakistan. It's well documented, and we don't know when he was released, but he wasn't released before September 11th. But his whereabouts were known. His whereabouts were known. They could have arrested him, and then we wouldn't have had a war. We wouldn't have had a war in Afghanistan, and we wouldn't have had the war against Iraq. But the saga required precisely that bin Laden survive and that al-Qaeda legend be sustained, and that they were pinpointed as being responsible for these attacks, which even Bob Graham says, no, it's impossible. So he's contradicting himself.
Okay. I know you don't have a lot of time with us, but I wanted to bring up one more point. Now, you talk about Senator Graham is essentially being part of the propaganda apparatus, and I'm wondering if there isn't a little bit more method to this madness around implicating the Saudis, because we remember we heard way back when, as you mentioned, Afghanistan was initially implicated without evidence, then later on Iraq was implicated as having some supported the Osama bin Laden. Again, factually erroneous, but no matter. I'm wondering, are we possibly looking at some kind of a military or other intervention into Saudi Arabia? I'm just wondering what the geostrategic or geopolitical ramifications of this accusations against Saudi Arabia, what is playing out here in the broader geopolitical field? Do you have any insights into that?
Well, you know, they're blaming everybody for supporting bin Laden. Iran was also blamed, and there was a lawsuit against Iran by the victims of 9/11. It's clear that as far as Washington is concerned, Saudi Arabia is a very staunch ally. Saudi Arabia and Pakistan are relays for the recruitment, the financing of political Islam, of the various al-Qaeda linked organizations on behalf of the CIA, always on behalf of the CIA. And that's known and documented for years and years. And Saudi Arabia acts in unison with its U.S. partners. But at the same time, by accusing Saudi Arabia, it's a way of, in effect, maintaining, preventing Saudi Arabia from exercising any kind of regional mandate. It really keeps Saudi Arabia as a proxy state. And you keep Saudi Arabia as a proxy state by collaborating with Saudi Arabia, as Saudi Arabia is waging a war against Yemen on behalf of the United States. Very convenient. And at the same time, you pressure Saudi Arabia in a way which is not always friendly, not necessarily the Saudi royal family, but members of the members of the business establishment who may have funded the terrorists, their foundations, and so on and so forth. And that serves, in a sense, to keep Saudi Arabia more or less entrapped in obeying and taking orders from Washington and not exercising any role as a sovereign state. It's not a sovereign state, it's a proxy state. And so are the Gulf. I mean, the Gulf monarchies, it's a larger sovereign state, proxy state than, let's say, the Emirates or Qatar. But nonetheless, these countries really are serving U.S. interests. They buy U.S. weapons, they buy British weapons, They waged the war on Syria by funding the ISIS, Daesh, and they invade and bomb Yemen again in very close coordination with Washington.
That almost sounds like what I'm hearing from you is that it's like, yeah, sure, just as the Taliban at one point was an ally back way in the 1990s, but they eventually kind of stepped out of line and had to be overthrown. And I guess it's almost as if they're saying, okay, Saudi Arabia, know your place. You know, this is like a warning. This effort to just implicate them is just a kind of a way of saying, don't, like you say, don't exercise your rights as a sovereign country.
Well, now there's a motion in the U.S. Senate to allow the victims of 9/11 to wage legal procedures. In fact, those legal procedures started very early, and then they were stalled. Against Saudi Arabia. And, you know, there's money behind it. There's money. If you wage a $1 trillion lawsuit against Saudi Arabia, there's money to be made. And if it has the support from high up, it has, you know. So this is a way of, it's part of the workings of a global economic geopolitical system, is that you don't want your allies in the Middle East, including Saudi Arabia, Turkey, I mean, if we're talking about the two countries which are supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria on behalf of the United States, you don't want them to gain any kind of hegemony or regional hegemony. But you use them, in this particular case, you're using them to support your intelligence assets, namely Al-Qaeda. And then you say, oh, you're supporting Al-Qaeda. We're going to go after you. And they can always, and then selectively the media will say, oh, Turkey and Saudi Arabia is supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria. I mean, these admissions have been made. What they don't say is that Saudi Arabia does it on behalf and in response to instructions which are relayed, you know, from Washington, from U.S. intelligence.
Okay. Well, Michel Chossudovsky, I guess we'll let you go now, but I want to thank you very much for your insights.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be on the program.
We've been speaking with Professor Michel Chossudovsky, award-winning author, professor emeritus of economics at the University of Ottawa, and founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization. Barry Zwicker is a veteran broadcaster, print journalist, and media critic. Since 2001, he's become increasingly known for his work promoting 9/11 truth, and 10 years ago authored the book Towers of Deception, The Media Cover-Up of 9/11. He joins us now from Toronto to share some of his thoughts on the 15th anniversary of 9/11. Glad to have you back, Barry Zwicker.
Well, I'm glad to be back. Thank you, Michael.
Now, you had already, in 2001, you'd already been reporting on how mainstream media tends to ignore stories that challenge dominant power interests, you know, whether it's, oil industry-owned media tend not to do a very good job of climate change research, or defense contract-owned TV outlets tend not to give you the most comprehensive analysis of, say, the first Gulf War in 1991. So I was wondering if you could look back on your experiences trying to interest the mainstream media in the 9/11 question, and relate any specific instances of suppression or even willful blindness or what have you that surprised even you at that time, and possibly surprise you even to this day.
Well, indeed. I do tend to be surprised or alarmed or despairing at the continuity of the de facto censorship exerted by the mainstream media, and it did well precede 9/11. But 9/11 is the probably classic case of censorship, blanket censorship across mainstream media, certainly. And there were two personal experiences, or at least one for sure, that I've had with 9/11 propaganda and control, to take that that general heading, control of the media. And I'll just focus on 9/11 anniversaries alone, and just specifically two, the 4th anniversary and the 15th. Now, it's important, I think, to bring up a quotation from American social critic Larry Ray in this connection. He said, quote, "Anniversaries are reservoirs of sacred power." And this quote is quite pertinent to us discussing this today. On a personal level, for instance, wedding anniversaries are occasions for celebration. But Ray is referring to events that the culture decides are important, such as the sinking of the Titanic or the coming 150th birthday of Canada. Now, the 4th anniversary of 9/11 was in 2005. It fell on a Sunday, as it did this past Sunday, for only the third time. And in late August of 2005, as can be found in the first chapter of my book that you mentioned, Towers of Deception, the Media Cover-Up of 9/11, I submitted an article. And, well, let me just quote briefly from my own book for a moment. This is how chapter one starts. August 22nd, 2005. This morning, I submit an article on spec to Peter Scowen, editor of the Ideas section of Sunday, the Sunday edition of Canada's largest circulation newspaper, the Toronto Star. The focus of the article, 9/11, is timely. It's 20 days before the 4th anniversary of the event. It happens to fall on a Sunday, which won't happen again until 2011. And at 4,500 words, the article is within the range Sunday publishes. While writing the article, I enlisted the help of distinguished writer colleagues more than I usually do. Several are more accomplished than writers than I am. They contributed improvements. They all praised the article in its near final form. So just a word here needs to be said, since this is the personal account of me and media control. A word needs to be said about the Sunday Star at that time. First of all, it was published by the most left-leaning daily newspaper in Canada then and probably now. Beyond that, the Sunday Star editorial unit was vibrantly progressive at the time, and the Ideas section within it even more so. And, for instance, just a brief instance, it had published an article written by a lawyer. And this article, I'm just looking it up quickly here right now. This article was by a lawyer, and it was headed "Fascism Then, Fascism Now?" question mark. And in this lengthy article, he wrote, the lawyer, "North America is on a fascist trajectory. We must recognize the threat for what it is, and we must change course." He commented, "By exploring the disturbing parallels between our own time and the era of overt fascism, we can avoid the same hideous mistakes." And he goes on. And my gosh, you know, he was just being prescient when you look at Donald Trump and the alt-right movement. Anyway, long story short, Peter Scowen, who was the editor I submitted my piece to, turned down my article. I'd suggested the headline, which really fitted the Sunday Star, "Your Sunday Puzzle, Three Amazing Secrets About 9/11. Sort of a typical kind of a grabby headline. Now, I didn't document my experience with Peter Scowen and the Sunday Star in my book because of sour grapes. Not at all. It was much more important than that. Sour grapes, you know, would be really nothing. It was a fine progressive paper's missed opportunity to speak truth to power. Because if there ever was a country, a city, a paper, an editor, and timing that could create a stir over the anomalies of the official 9/11 story, it would be Canada, Toronto, Sunday, Peter Scowen, the Ideas section, and the 4th anniversary of 9/11. Now, two more points about this personal experience. Peter Scowen himself had written a book, I've got it right beside me, entitled Rogue Nation, The America the Rest of the World Knows, sharply critical of U.S. foreign policies, and which contains a full account of the role of the CIA in overthrowing the democratic government of Iran in 1953. And on that second point, let me quote from Peter Scowen's book, okay? And it suggests what he knew and did not know about the events at Ground Zero on the morning of 9/11. He has a sister, Amy, who was an office worker on the 54th floor of the South WTC Tower on 9/11. Peter, being an alert journalist, recorded a telephone interview with his sister later that day. And in the transcript, this is from Peter's book, we find this. Here's what his sister Amy said. And then we were walking up Broadway and went into a store to get a battery for our cell phones. And we heard a radio broadcaster describe how she had been at the base of the building when a huge fireball exploded out of the basement of the building. She was implying there was a bomb in the basement of the World Trade Center as well. So the thing is that Peter Scowen has the political background, and he had the firsthand experience with his sister of knowing that something was seriously amiss about the official story of 9/11, even as reported in his own paper and all other papers. And this speaks, I think, for itself, except to finish off this sort of your double-barreled question to me about media control. We can come down to this past weekend, the 15th anniversary of 9/11, and it relates to what Peter Scowen's sister Amy reported. And in this past weekend, there was a tremendous conference in New York City, a two-day conference entitled Focus on Justice. And during that two-day conference, where experts on 9/11 testified, and including by Skype from various countries around the world, about the details of the anomalies and the absurdities and the contradictions in the official story of 9/11, and Graham McQueen, Professor Graham McQueen of McMaster, who had studied and did a paper on all 12,000 pages of post 9/11 interviews with emergency personnel in New York. These are pages kept secret until the New York Times launched a lawsuit against the city and forced these transcripts of these interviews into the public arena. In them, dozens of New York firefighters and Port Authority personnel testify as to these explosions that Peter's sister Amy referred to at the base of all three towers, you know, WTC 1 and 2 and WTC 7. And then if you fast forward to last Sunday, the 15th anniversary, the coverage in the newspapers and elsewhere ranged from the maudlin to the bizarre. For instance, long human interest stories about individuals who were in the Twin Towers but survived, stories about the fragment of a girder from one of the towers that the city of New York gave to the citizens of Gander, Newfoundland, because those citizens took in the stranded airline passengers on the day of 9/11. A lot of coverage of a stage play by a husband and wife, one Canadian, one American team, that touches in a totally non-factual, non-political way on 9/11.
Fluff,
that
basically.
Play is coming to Canada. It's just, this censorship goes on and the distraction goes on.
Well, I think we're going to have to call to close it here. Thanks so much for coming on and sharing these thoughts on this 15th anniversary occasion.
Thank you very much, Michael. Thank you.
We've been joined by Barry Zwicker, a veteran broadcaster, print journalist, and media critic. He is based in Toronto. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. The Global Research News Hour welcomes new affiliate Caper Radio CJBU 107.3 FM out of Sydney, Nova Scotia, who will begin airing the program on Wednesday mornings from 8 till 9 a.m. Check out their website at caperradio.ca. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.